Welcome to the Pragmatic Podcast for July 1st, 2009. Michael Swain and the Pragmag.
One of the great things about being a writer is if you're going to explain something to other people, you've got to understand it pretty well yourself. At least you've got to understand the part that you're explaining. And of course, since I don't have to make my living at it, I can gloss over, not bother to learn a lot of details.
That's Michael Swain, editor-in-chief of Prag Pub, a new monthly magazine available from the Pragmatic Programmers. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and this week I talked to Mike about his history with magazines. Most recently, he was editor-in-chief of Dr. Dobbs magazine for more than 20 years. When Dr. Dobbs ceased to exist as a magazine, he contacted Dave and Andy, and they began to discuss
magazines and what's happening to them, where they're going, and the virtues that magazines have that we don't want to see lost. There's something really cool about the commitment to deliver interesting content on a regular basis and the relationship that you can create with readers that way, as opposed to books, which I love too, but you write a book and then it's done. Magazines really are about a kind of relationship with the reader. So we brainstormed about where magazines are going and can we create a magazine in a time when magazines are disappearing right and left. It was clear we didn't want to do any sort of print magazine, but there was an opportunity here to address the community that's grown up around Pragmatic Programmers in a new way.
What does it mean to be producing a magazine for this medium as opposed to print? You were with Dr. Dobbs for 20-some years doing this regular print publication, and so you were used to thinking in terms of column inches and all the constraints that go along with that. How do you think differently about a magazine in this setting?
In print, you've got to deliver this thing to the printer, and then the printer has their deadline and their schedule, and you don't get to see what you've done for a while. With this, of course, you need to allow time for copy editing and so on, but you can be pretty close to the very last release and still be making changes and discovering new things you want to add. So there's more immediacy. It's not like blogging, but there's that.
You talk about a magazine being a relationship. How do people consuming a magazine then feel differently than people that read a blog or read a book?
Well, I'd hope it's because of the commitment. You know, when I was young, I used to love to go out to the mailbox and know that magazine's coming one of these days, Boy's Life or whatever it was I was subscribing to at the time. Magazine of fantasy and science fiction. It was something to look forward to. I think the commitment to regular delivery is something that helps to create a bond and a connection. I think this is a wide open question. We're exploring something here, and Dave and Andy were really clear that we want this magazine to be a collaboration with the readers. So we're putting something out, and we're hoping they'll tell us.
I saw in one of your blog posts, you describe it as sort of an agile process that you're hoping that the magazine evolves in some ways that the reader might push you in certain directions.
There's a sort of recursiveness to that, too. We want to engage them in a conversation about how we can better engage them in a conversation.
As a magazine guy, you look at the state of the industry. Is this something that it needed to be a new venture that said, okay, we're going to look at this with totally fresh eyes?
For me, looking at it with fresh eyes, going somewhere else, dealing with guys who everything they do, they want to do in an agile way, or all about new ideas. That's something that I was very open to at this point and really excites me. And I think is necessary to explore where you could go with the elements that still work of the concept of a magazine.
Do you want to talk a little bit about where you come from? You know, your background, you've been interested in magazines and producing them since you were a kid. You look at your schooling and you started off majoring in psych and then ended up with a graduate degree in computer science. How did you make all these transitions?
Yeah, I was pursuing a PhD in psychology and sort of found myself taking more computer science classes and classes in AI than psych classes. And I guess I kind of had a crisis of faith in psychology as a science and just kind of shifted from one major to another. So that's the academic transition, but really the breakthrough for me into software and programming and computers came when I went to work for a friend who in Bloomington, Indiana, who'd opened one of the first computer stores back in the 70s. And he was just the ideal boss in a lot of ways, Ray Burrell of the data domain. Ray would take on projects that made absolutely no sense, you know, from a business point of view, just because he wanted the challenge. People would be doing bizarre things with these early microcomputers, trying to run their businesses with setting up multi-user systems, and anything they wanted to do, Ray was into it, and he'd say, yeah, we'll do it. And then he'd give the project to his employees, and so we got wonderful challenges. Worked for him for a few years, and then got an opportunity to move to the West Coast and work for InfoWorld magazine when it was just getting started.
And so that was your move into publishing?
Yeah. I wrote a couple things for InfoWorld before moving out, and then actually got to be one of the founding editors. I mean, it had been a publication before, but it got turned into a weekly news publication. I've been trying to be a writer pretty much all my life, and had trouble finishing things. And going to work for a weekly just solved that problem immediately.
How's it managing other people writing on deadline?
I love working with writers. I love being an editor. I just connect with writers, and I know what they're going through. And I know I'm that same person, but I'll put it off till the last minute. And I've learned better a little bit, and I know all the little white lies you tell your editor. Oh, yeah, it's almost done, and I just have a few things to clean up here. Just give me 24 hours, give me an hour.
Is that polite for I'll start it soon?
Yeah, exactly. That's what it means.
So can you tell me why technology? Because for most of your career, you've been editing and writing about technology.
Yeah, well, it goes back to those back in the 70s, falling out of love with psychology and sort of into love with AI and software. I'm not a professional programmer these days and haven't been one for a very long time, but I program. I hack away every week. I'm playing around with something. I've always loved the freedom and power of it, the ability to create these worlds and set up the problem and then solve it.
So you're not a professional programmer, yet you do understand programs and programming languages in deep ways. I know that the first time I ever thought I understood what functional programming was about was after reading your article about it. So do you think you approach this hacking around and programming differently because you're going to explain it to other people, or you're going to do something differently than using it in a day job to achieve a software result?
Well, that's an interesting question. Yeah. One of the great things about being a writer is if you're going to explain something to other people, you've got to understand it pretty well yourself. At least you've got to understand the part that you're explaining. And of course, since I don't have to make my living at it, I can gloss over and not bother to learn a lot of details that real programmers have to immerse themselves in.
And I don't know if it's your background in psych or just who you are as a person, but you also get a feel from reading your work, including your book, Fire in the Valley, that you understand and are very interested in the people behind the technology, too.
It's my perhaps prejudice that the people behind the technology are fascinating. Maybe they're no more fascinating than people in other fields, but to me, they are. When I had the opportunity while working at InfoWorld to research Fire in the Valley, that was just the coolest thing, because we would go talk to these people who created companies on their kitchen table or in their garage. And first we'd have a conversation about what they're doing, their latest product and the usual business kind of news conversation for InfoWorld. And then we'd say, so we're working on this book and we want to know how you guys got started. And they'd let their hair down and tell us the real stories and talk about how they felt about what they were doing. And the stories were fascinating because they just were not Harvard Business School case studies.
And these are people like?
Yeah, like Jobs and Wozniak and Lee Felsenstein, who created the processor tech Sol and the Osborne One.
And so with this background, You then moved from InfoWorld to Dr. Dobbs for a long time. What were you doing at Dr. Dobbs? The focus of the articles are very different there.
Yeah, well, I'd been a fan of Dr. Dobbs since before I even went to InfoWorld. Dr. Dobbs was started by the Dennis Allison, Bob Albrecht, the People's Computer Company, and it was very counterculture in its spirit. It was a nonprofit. By the time I'd been at InfoWorld for a few years, they'd taken the nonprofit thing a little too seriously at Dr. Dobbs, and they were just about to go out of business. And there was this company, that subsidiary of a German company that was just getting started, and they were in the process of secretly planning to buy Dr. Dobbs. And they got in touch with me because I'd written something favorably about Dr. Dobbs and InfoWorld. And I agreed to come on as editor-in-chief when they did the transition. And it was, again, a really cool place to be at that time because I love Dr. Dobbs, but it was sort of dying, and these people were going to put some money into it, a little bit of money, and I got a chance to kind of ride that. So we kind of shifted gears a little bit, and the Macintosh was just coming out, so we jumped on that and covered that, and there was a lot of exciting stuff happening.
It was a great time to be covering technology. There was just so much new in that era. You know, we're about to release this book on the iPhone. And I was talking to the authors that the iPhone in my pocket is more powerful than the Mac that I went through graduate school with. So it's, again, a very exciting time for technology.
It is. And yeah, I don't think we know yet what all that's going to mean. The whole concept of your primary computing device being something you carry around with you. When you're working on sitting at a desk and working at your computer, you know, when things slow down, you can get up and go get a cup of coffee. There's a pace that you can accept there that maybe you don't accept while you're holding this thing in your hand and maybe walking around. Maybe different agreements you make with time when you're using a device like that. Plus, then on the other hand, there are different problems with time. If a lot of your applications live partly online, that creates other connections with time. I think it's a very different realm we're moving into. And then, of course, the device communicates back to you in other ways. It has other senses. It can tell what orientation it's in. It can tell if it happens to be near your ear.
And it can tell if it's near other devices. This is, I think, a very exciting time in technology. And here you are launching a magazine. Is the focus technology? What are you envisioning this magazine will be about?
I think it's very close to the charter of the Prags. Yeah, it's going to be about technology and about software development, but it's also about lives of people who are connected with technology. You could articulate much better than I could what the Life line of books is all about, but we want to address that as well. But even beyond that, you said, is it going to be about technology? And yeah, we may be publishing articles here that this wouldn't make any sense to expand into books, articles about, you know, certain kinds of technologies that it's not a tool. It's not a pragmatic bookshelf kind of topic, yet it still may be fascinating for people who are connected with this company.
And in a way, it gets back to what you were saying about the differences of time and in dealing with devices. A magazine has a different time agreement so that you can publish on a technology before it's time to publish a book on it, or you can look back at a technology long after it would be useful to publish a book on it to see, you know, how it's doing.
You can do that, exactly. You can also take a look at a technology that you think might not make it and talk about why. And that's certainly not something you're going to want to write a book about.
Or you can cheerlead for a technology you hope will make it but isn't on track to.
Right.
So you're releasing this week. What can we expect in the debut edition?
Well, we're going to talk a little about the condition we're in, the economic situation we're in, and what that means to software developers. We've got a great article from Andy Lester about keeping your tech job. Andy, of course, has written a book for us on finding the tech job you love, but this article is about keeping the job you've already got. He talks about how you really need to think about keeping your job in the same way you think about looking for a job. You need to be sort of interviewing for this job you've already got. We've got two articles about closure. I'm an old Lisp hacker from way back, so the idea that I could program in Lisp but have the power of all the Java libraries, that seems pretty cool. That's kind of neat. We've got a pretty technical hands-on article that lets people kind of get a real flavor for Clojure. But we've also got an interview with Rich Hickey, who created Clojure, talking about why Clojure and how it differs from some other languages. I got Dave Thomas to write about, I think we're calling it How We Do the Things We Do. There are a lot of cool things that Dave and Andy have created, technologies for producing magazines and producing books. And people ask about them. How do you do that? So they've committed to a regular series of explaining some of the inside details of how we do the things we do. Yeah, it's kind of cute.
So it's going to be a regular publication. How often are you putting this out?
This is a monthly publication.
What is it you're most excited about with this project now that it's real and at the time that this airs, it's shipping?
As I said, I like deadlines, and I do. I love the idea of creating something new every month. So just that alone is pretty exciting. It's taken a while to get this thing launched, as is usual with projects. And now we're launching, and now I'm into that every monthly cycle. And that's just kind of constant excitement. Another cool thing about this particular endeavor is that I get to tap into the pool of writers for the Pragmatic Bookshelf, and I'm getting to know these guys, these people. They're pretty cool, and it's a real luxury as an editor to have 100 really sharp people who know the subject matter that I want covered and who are kind of eager to write for me.
That's Michael Swain, editor-in-chief of Prag Pub, a new monthly magazine available from the Pragmatic Programmers. You can read the first issue of the magazine at pragprog.com/magazines. And as always, you can find more information about our books, screencasts, and training at pragprog.com. Our podcasts are at pragprog.com/podcasts. And you can join the discussion at forums.pragprog.com. The music for this podcast was composed and performed by Andy Hunt. For the Pragmatic Programmers, I'm Daniel Steinberg.